And good morning and welcome to the program. I'm your host, George Rideout, and as always, working the soundboard is Lynn. Born in Northern Ireland, Michael Tesserian is an expert on the occult histories of Ireland and America. He has made the deepest researches into Atlantis, the origins of evil, and into the Irish origins of civilization. Author of the acclaimed book Atlantis, Alien Visitation and Genetic Manipulation, and is the producer and presenter of the Origins and Oracle series, which explores ancient mysteries and forbidden knowledge. His many appearances on metaphysical radio and TV programs, along with his lectures and workshops, have given rise to the name Teacher's Teacher. To visit Michael's amazing websites, one of the best sites I have come across myself, log on to www.michaeltesserian.com. He is metaphysician extraordinaire. He is Michael Tesserian, and we are lucky to have him here with us this morning. Are you there, Michael?
Yes, George. How are you doing? Nice to be here.
Oh, sure. It's nice to have you. We talked a little bit off air there, and I told you I watched two of your videos last night. They were truly awesome. I just had to tell you, they're just incredible.
Thank you. Which ones were those?
I watched the 2012 and the Origins of Evil.
Thank you. Yeah. Can you believe that the you watched these online, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, the Origins of Evil wasn't even planned. You know, there's about over 100,000 people have seen that just in like about 2-3 months period. And, you know, I get a lot of compliments for that particular presentation. And yet, you know, again, it was a fluke that it was even filmed. So, you know, that just shows you how fate works.
Yeah, it's amazing. Now, you're the author of three books so far. Is that correct?
Well, there's a whole bunch of books, you know, that I'm working on. One is actually available, and there'll be two more available this spring. Actually three more coming out in spring, hopefully, if all goes well, of course, you know. But yeah, right now we have the DVD series, which is 6 box sets, and also one book, which is the book on Atlantis. Those are available to the public right now.
Now, you've given so many presentations, workshops, and classes on things from Western magical tradition to indigo children to psychic vampires, symbol literacy, origins of evil, the Irish origins of civilization, subversive use of sacred symbolism in the media. I tell you, man, your research drawer must be incredibly full.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's too full. And, you know, have to do a lot of presentations, and, you know, it takes away from, you know, doing the books. But if you do the books, then it takes away from, you know, doing live presentations. So I'm always anxious to, you know, do radio shows like this one. Everything in life is about keeping a sort of a happy medium and making sure that, you know, you're producing information and working on what you love, but also that, you know, you're not just sitting in the dark. I mean, you know, the radio, the media, the internet, you know, what good is it if people are studying these things, but it doesn't actually get broadcast to the world, you know? So I'm always anxious to do good radio shows, but, you know, I say no to a lot of gigs. I say no to a lot of different, you know, opportunities because, you know, I just don't feel that the integrity is there or whatever, you know, so I have to screen a lot of different people, you know. But I saw your site, you know, checked out your show, really liked it. So, you know, I'm always anxious to work with people, but, you know, they have to be the right kind of people as well.
I sure appreciate you having you here because, yeah, I'm the same way. I you know, I like to have guests that same thing, that not only do I want to hear what they have to say, but I want other people to hear what they have to say.
Yeah, this is the key thing, you know. And I tell people that who are also very pessimistic. You know, I get a lot of emails, and some of them, you know, tend to say, you know, hey, I'm like you, I study these things, but when I'm talking to, you know, my friends and my colleagues about these kinds of subjects, they just completely ostracize me, or they call me a crank, or, you know, they make fun of me and so on. You know, how do you keep up doing it? How do you keep your optimism? You know, so I get a lot of that. And my response is, you know, that it doesn't really matter that other people like that respond in that way. This is sacred knowledge, and therefore you're going to have, you know, resistance. But that's when the test is whether you really love the knowledge for itself or what it's going to bring you. And, you know, I think about it, you know, there's a lot of people in this world that are into the subjects, any subject, but certainly these occult subjects, because, you know, it brings them a certain ego fulfillment, and therefore when they're troubled and when suddenly the subject matter starts to test them, or when fate starts to test them, you know, then they back off and they get pessimistic, and they kind of wish they'd never started, you know. But I really love this information, and it's something that I've always done all my life, long before any type of, you know, public notoriety or anything like that ever happened, you know. And I'd still be doing it regardless of that. So it's just about whether you love it or not.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm exactly the same way. And I remember you saying on one of the shows that you started like when you were 13 or something. And for me, same thing. My first mentor came into my life when I was 12. And so it's been like I've been doing this kind of thing all my life. And it's a thing for me that I think is so important right now, that you have to do what you are. And you have to live your truth, and no matter what that is. And I think also that when a person does that, the universe will take care of you.
Absolutely. You know, wasn't it Charles Lindbergh when he was flying across the Atlantic, and they said, how is it possible for you, under all that stress, with days and days and days of not sleeping before you left, and then you're cooped up in this tiny, tiny little airplane, you know, how did you manage to stay awake for those three, you know, days, you know, 72 hours or more? How is it possible, he said, when you really need it, you know, unseen forces come to your aid. If you're doing what you love, if what you're doing really matters, you will be assisted. And pretty much that's the story of my life, because there are a lot of challenges on the road. You do get put off. People around you, you know, will question what you're doing and try to force you into the, you know, consensus trance and try to bait you. And you know, there's a lot of adversarial energy that can occur. So, you know, again, the fundamental thing is that you have to do it because it's your bliss. If this is something you're just, you know, doing because, oh, well, you know, for any other reason, then you will have to stop. It'll either destroy you or it will cause you, you know, a great deal of sorrow. So, you know, being a servant of the truth doesn't mean you know the whole truth. This is what a lot of people also, you know, maybe I get emails from people, you know, saying, hey, man, you know, you keep on saying that you know the truth, or, you know, you keep using that word. What gives you the right, you know? And I keep saying to them, but I don't say I know the whole truth. You can serve truth, but you still, you know, maybe don't know the whole thing. To your all intents and purposes, you are a person who is trying to deal with what is real. Sharpen your intuition, sharpen your reason, weigh everything that comes in front of you, study knowledge, get your discernment sharp so you can tell what is false, you know?
Yeah.
Pursue the truth. It doesn't mean that you are the truth or that you know the whole truth, you know, or that you're moving from that kind of egotism, you know, but there is a sacred archive of knowledge that is within every person, and we have been given a reason to know what is right. And most of the world, you know, couldn't care less about that. People who do, you know, they can find themselves very much in a kind of a wilderness, thinking that they're alone. And therefore, the internet right now, you know, and DVDs and radio shows, and it's very important for us to use these kinds of means so that people who are also struggling and looking for the light do not feel that they're completely alone, because they otherwise could feel like that.
Same here. It's something I hear a lot about, you know, people saying that, you know, they're so alone, they have nobody to talk to. And then when they find somebody, they just kind of want to latch right onto you because they're, you know, they don't have anyone else to bounce things off or to share with. And I myself just feel very blessed because through it all, I've always had a number of people that I was able to walk the road with. And in that, it's just amazing how much of a blessing that really is.
Well, that really is a blessing. I also agree with that. And, you know, this is one of the, you know, one of the projects that I'm working on is about psychic vampirism. And what you said there actually contains a lot of wisdom. And that is because that there wouldn't be such a phenomena as any kind of vampirism, any kind of energy vampirism at all, if there were not children of the light. Because it is children of the light, people who have an intense light, an intense love, who are inner directed, who are auto-generated, you know, people who are motivated themselves. It is those individuals who are the most affected by, you know, the negative attentions of other people. It's a very strange quirk of fate. But, you know, the person who's already dark and has no energy is obviously not the victim of psychic vampirism to any great extent. As I've been studying this, I find that it's people of a certain kind of genius, a certain kind of spirit, and a certain kind of power. You know, and even if I may say it's an abused word, but I'm going to say it, a certain kind of superiority, a moral superiority.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've so trashed that word that we forget that there are morally superior beings on Earth.
Yeah.
And those individuals are going to be beset by those who see that light, you know, and they want to plug into it. And I find that people on the spiritual path, one of the reasons why a lot of them give up is because they get surrounded by these kinds of individuals, or they already have that kind of adversarial energy in their life, and they don't know how to deal with it or cleanse from it. So this is a big question. You know, we have a blog. You know, people can go to my blog and see comments from people. We're working on this vampirism project, and it's just a really fascinating subject for those who are interested in that kind of thing.
Yeah, it is. You know, and it's just so cool how this has already started this morning, because it's exactly the thing I wanted to start off with this morning. I want to read a little paragraph that you have on your site, because it's just awesome, and it's about psychic vampirism. The man who has murdered his own self becomes a predator who lives to consume what others create. The self-murdered person is the greatest threat in the world and is both violent and destructive toward himself and to everyone he encounters. He can occupy positions of little importance or of the greatest importance. He can destroy a single life or that of a world. He cares nothing for the trail of destruction and ruin that he leaves, only for the satiation of his insatiable appetite. He seeks you and all that is yours. Wow, that is just pretty heavy. And
did I write that? I must have forgotten. Yeah, that is heavy.
But, you know, it's so true. And what is exactly a psychic vampire, and how do we recognize them?
Well, it's impossible to say. It's not one thing. It's not one thing. And one of the reasons why I've taken so long, because I've studied this subject all my life and have been very, very hesitant, George, to even do anything about printing this or, you know, writing about it or doing a DVD. With all the other work that I've done, you know, that the road to a book or the road to a DVD, you know, has been pretty obvious. It's just, of course, taken the hard work to do it. But, you know, it's been quite easy to say, okay, this would make a good program that other people are interested in. With the psychic vampirism thing, I've had to be very cautious because, you see, it's one of those subjects that can easily be manipulated in various ways. And it's because of the ambiguity of what you're talking about. And let me explain exactly what I mean by this so that, you know, because we'll make radio history here, because it's the first time I've ever mentioned this or said it. If you don't present this information correctly, then the wrong kind of people can get off the hook because of their deeds.
Yes.
In other words, there's a penchant within all human beings for denial, for copping out, you know, and not facing who they are. So if you don't present a subject like psychic vampirism correctly, and people go around thinking, oh, well, all my problems are caused by X, well, then, you know, you cause a lot of problems because you just fed somebody with the whole accusation model to be running around saying, oh, but that person's a psychic vampire. Oh, I bought a book on a spinner rack, you know, in Kinko's or wherever, and it told me all about these energy vampires. So I've noticed that, you know, in the past, with certain websites and certain books on this subject, this is what they kind of are, maybe consciously or unconsciously. They create this little, you know, cliche in which people can live by saying, well, see, I can't do anything. It's impossible for me to get what I want or do what I want or be a good person because, you see, there's all these people around sucking my energy. So I got to be very careful, you see, that they don't provide yet another denial mechanism for individuals.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there is actually a bona fide philosophy of energy vampirism, and it's been in the world for a long, long time. The Bible talks about it. Ancient religions talk about it. The myths and legends certainly talk about it, and it is a phenomenon that is occurring in our society, very close to home sometimes. And therefore, you know, I feel like it needs to be known to the world, but at the same time, the last thing that I want to provide for people is this whole other denial mechanism that gets them off the hook of responsibility. Because this world is just itching to get off responsibility. And, you know, responsibility itself is a huge psychological crisis in our world.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a certain responsibility I feel then for bringing this forward. And that's one of the reasons why I'm doing it very deliberately and, you know, working out the right format for it, the right way to deliver this information so that it doesn't get is misused, you know, by people, and if it is, then you catch them on it and go, wait a minute, that's not what this person's talking about. You know, they're not talking about you, you know, being in a state of irresponsibility.
And not only that, it also puts you out there for the feeders.
True, but, you know, people like me are out there no matter what. A lot of my experiences, you know, the people that I've talked to who've had this happen to them, you know, I think it's Let me answer the original question is, what is it? You know, how do you observe it? To give people a basic idea of what it is that, you see, the human being is a person who has a choice to make in their life about whether they motivate by their own energy or by the energy of somebody else. You know, it's like Shakespeare has said, you know, like monsters from the deep, the human beings prey upon one another. You know, the Christ in the Gospel of Thomas, in the Bible, they've all spoken about it. And, we have to diagnose it, because there is this pernicious thing going on. It's just that we have not, you know, sharpened our intuition to notice that it's going on. There's no meter, no electronic gadget that you can pull out and say, oh, look, this person is, you know, taking my life force or taking my energy. And because that scientific device does not exist, psychic vampires are there able to basically flourish, because it's very, very hard to accuse them. It's like I was saying in the Origins of Evil talk and in the Future of Mankind talk, that unfortunately there is no police that you can go to, and there's no judge that you can go to, and there's no court that you can go to when psychic violence is being done to you. In fact, you may not even know that it's being done.
Yeah.
You know, child who's grown up, say, in an abusive, you know, family where the parents are completely violating that child's rights and are even physically or, you know, in any other way abusing that child. You see, that child doesn't know any other reality. And it might grow up thinking that a lot of that is completely normal and then even go on to repeat the behavior because it's literally not understood in its mind that that is completely off the wall, abnormal behavior that doesn't go on elsewhere. So there's a critical issue where we're not even educated, George. We're not even aware of some of the violence that we, you know, do to others.
Yeah.
Now, the most important thing, though, is the violence that we do to ourselves, which is, you know, used to is can be called masochism or sadism to the self. There is a whole form of unseen emotional violence, psychic violence, that is done in the human race, and a great deal of it is done from one person to the other. This is what chiefly interests me. But then I started to notice that there is a lot of this emotional violence that goes on, and because it is, you know, if you kill somebody, you know, you will be hunted, you will be caught, and you will be accountable, and you may spend the rest of your life in jail.
Right.
But yet, we do infinitely, can you imagine, infinitely worse crimes to people. We destroy their emotions. We can actually try to murder their soul. There's actually, this goes on in life, more than we'd want to even imagine. We basically, you know, drop atom bombs on people's emotions. We conspire to do things that, you know, suck their energy and drive them mad and take away their hope and all of these psychic things. And yet the human race is not even aware that this is violence. It just takes it for granted because, again, you know, our eyes have not been opened. So to me, it's absolutely critical that human beings start to open their ideas to this kind of psychic tyranny, this kind of sadism to the self, and then from that move on to understand more about the kind of violence that we perpetrate on people, which may not be illegal in the, you know, quote-unquote sense of the word, the obvious sense of the word. It's not going to happen overnight. This is a, you know, I'm hoping to kickstart this information, this knowledge, so that, you know, the human race does start to get savvy about this, because physical violence, criminal violence, is not the only kind of violence that's going on in this world.
That's for sure. To me, what it's all about is the awareness of self, and through that, all these things can become known to us. If you don't believe that somebody can hurt you psychically, can they?
They can hurt you whether you believe it or not.
Exactly. Oh, I'm so glad.
Even if you are aware of it.
Yeah.
I have heard of cases in which the, you know, people who are in the spiritual community and who know how to cleanse themselves, I mean very deeply, you know, who know how to change their energy, cleanse themselves, they're still under attack. Maybe not as bad, you know. But, I mean, how can you avoid it? It's like somebody going out into the streets and walking downtown and expecting that you're not going to inhale the fumes, you know, or get the dust on you. What we've got to understand is this is a natural phenomenon. As long as people are in the kind of pathetic, inauthentic, and, you know, low chakra state that they're in, full of envy, and envy is different than jealousy, full of anger, full of repressed, you know, content, you better believe that you're going to be walking in a sea of their energy out there. So just like we know that there's weather and you have to protect against the weather, the human race needs to learn what are the keys, what are the ways of you know, finding out about this. I said earlier that it's difficult to identify one, and all I meant by that is that it's each individual case is kind of different because each individual is different.
Exactly, yeah.
Each person is different, and therefore their particular kind of interaction with a psychic vampire is going to be different because it's all based on your own profile. And the vampire, these are usually very cunning people, they modify their behavior based on each situation. Say there is this hypothetical vampire that you know at work. Well, that person isn't going to operate the same way with you as there are for the person in the next office or the people they know at home or their neighbors. They got a different face for everybody. So what I can provide is a general philosophy of this subject. And then it's up to the person to, you know, in all good feeling and in the right way to sort of utilize that philosophy and make sure they're not using it, as I said, for a cop-out where they're, you know, maybe not overcoming some of their own issues because they believe erroneously that other people are preventing them. So it's a catch-22 situation that you can prepare, you can give the tools to somebody. You can sort of lay out the general understanding and show case studies and histories and all of these things and go into the subject in an academic way. But, you know, I'm not responsible for how people apply it. They have to know that, wait a minute, you know, my father may have been sort of a cruel individual, but he wasn't a psychic vampire. He was just a messed up guy who was pretty much good at heart. Or that person who's done some, you know, kind of rotten social things, you know, maybe they beat up people or they were in a gang. You know, that person's a criminal, but it doesn't mean they're a psychic vampire. A psychic vampire is a very specific kind of person that's not just, you know, a normal criminal or some person who's kind of, you know, did some bad things in their life, you know, who maybe went down the wrong road. Some people can be very good at heart. And some people who can appear extremely pure and extremely spiritual can be the worst kind of vampires.
Oh, so true, man. So
right?
True.
So this is an education. And it's very important to kind of find this out before they mess with you, because, you know, it can be very difficult to find out that the guru you've been following, for instance, you know, I'm not going to give any examples here, but, you know, the point being that, you know, the priest, the beautiful lover that you've been with, or the guru you've been thinking is also wonderful and is going to give you enlightenment, you know, you'd be shocked to find out that these people that you've invested a tremendous amount of faith in and appear in front of you is just so bloody wonderful. Excuse my Irish, but, you know, they turn out to be these kinds of beings that we're talking about. So, you know, it can be a shocker, and it's important to be able to test for it first, at least, to test for it, you know, couldn't hurt, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and that's why it is so important to at least have a basic understanding of what it is to realize when it's happening to you, because a lot of people don't even know that, may not even know that they're doing it, but the ones that are truly the ones to watch out for are just the ones that you mentioned that know exactly what they're doing and, you know, are pretending to be something that they're not.
Right. Now, of course, we all need others, and we all need things from people. So the issue of psychic vampirism goes very deeply into motive. You may need something from a neighbor, or you may need help from a person. That doesn't mean that you're a psychic vampire taking their energy, because you're giving those people the choice, you know, to not help you.
Mm-hmm.
And you love them anyway. It's like saying, you know, okay, I need this person's help, but okay, I see that person's, you know, not able to help me today, or, you know, that's fine. And you basically have a humanness about you. You know, I talk in my Atlantis books about the old alien intervention and the fact that our DNA may have an alien, you know, component to it. It's kind of like that. You know, I try not to cross the two subjects over too much, but the vampire, in a way, is sort of like that. There's a lack of humanness. And it comes, as you read from that quote, that these individuals, because of some primal wound and maybe some past life stuff, I really don't like to get into that too, because it takes you off on a whole other metaphysical tangent, and I like to keep this kind of content. It's already, this content's far out enough without getting into karmas and the past lives. So, but just from a purely psychological point of view, the vampire is basically a troubled and hurt person themselves. They have a negative, you know, relationship with themselves, possibly because of a primal wound situation in their own past. And from that point, they've decided to, you know, stop feeling. Because the pain that they suffered at that point of the primal wound was so intense that, unlike the rest of us, they chose a radical way to deal with that pain, which was to stop feeling altogether. Now, when you meet somebody like that, you might not notice that. You might not notice that they are unemotional people, because they're able to camouflage that. One of the ways that I've studied that they do that is that they tend to be extremely sensationalistic, because if you're not looking very closely, sensation and emotion can appear to be the same, but they're not the same. But you wouldn't know that unless you'd really have the ability to study it. So that you know, they can come across as very charming and extremely sensationalistic, and because pretty much, you know, life is tough and we like these kinds of people, and they appear on the surface to make life easy and make life a joy, you know, they give us a certain pep. And they seem to have a lighter, you know, gayer energy around them. They have a certain ways of making themselves very attractive in this kind of way, very untouched and unsullied. And, of course, then we feel that these are very attractive, possibly even very spiritually advanced people. And, of course, we have a natural drive, don't we, that wants to be around good, exciting, you know, light, and very friendly people.
Yeah.
Well, how many times have you seen the fly caught in honey and it's dead?
Yeah.
Right? It had a beautiful death. That fly had an absolutely beautiful death. The only problem is it's dead.
Yeah.
So we got to, you know, and our ancients knew this. That's why they came up with these phrases like, you know, all that glitters is not gold, and, you know, the problem with something that's too sweet is that it would kill you. You know, all the phraseology is because they knew that these kinds of people existed. The only problem is that we lack the shamanic tradition today to be able to cull these kinds of people and deal with them in our tribes, because we basically still are a tribal people, by the way. It's just that we don't have the shaman anymore who's going to observe the child, observe these people to see if they exist, monitor, you know, individuals that are going through their teenage problems and maybe they've been abused, and then look to heal it. We only have doctors that are good at the patch up, you know. They don't want to they just want to fix the machine. They don't really care for the psyche of people.
Yeah, the quick fix.
That's right. And unfortunately, because of this, then these kinds of psychic vampire people who've murdered their own soul, who've torn out their own emotions, they can be walking loose in the world, and there's more of them than you think.
Yeah, definitely. Well, we're going to take our first break, and when we come back, I want to ask you how we can protect ourselves against the psychic vampire.
Okay.
Here is Uriah Heep and Rainbow Demon. Enjoy. And welcome back to the program. You're listening to Sacred Space here on CJUM 101.5 FM out of Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. And we're sitting here talking with Michael Tazarian right now about psychic vampirism. And before we left for break, Michael, I wanted to ask you about, now that we know a little bit about the psychic vampire, how do we protect against him?
Well, you know, it's like in any kind of any kind of disease situation or any kind of toxic situation, even if it be just a mere problem with cleanliness in the home or, you know, any kind of clutter, because that's what this psychic vampirism is, basically. It's an assault on your sovereignty. First of all, it's reason. It's an education into the subject, a simple understanding that the phenomena exist, and then from there you move. The key way to really discover it, if it is happening in your life, you see, or you suspect it's happening to you, is to basically be very observant of your own energy fluctuation. And, you know, I go into this in greater length in the DVD that's going to be coming out, but again, it's all about a knowledge of the self. I think you mentioned this earlier. Nothing happens in this universe for no reason. Everything that happens to a man, including some of the worst things that can happen, you know, like having to spend time in jail or whatever, there's, you know, you may curse it, you may hate it, all these adversarial and sometimes even preposterously, seemingly meaningless things that happen to us, all of the domestic minutiae that just absorbs all of our energy. So, you know, if you look at life, it just seems that there is so much chaotic stuff that, you know, one has to handle in just the course of one life. And basically, people can start getting into pessimism and think, you know, it's just too crazy, it's too much, I don't understand it. What we got to realize is that there's a meaning and a reason for everything that happens. So even in the case of, you know, when you've suffered enormous violence in, say, a family situation or domestic abuse, or that you've, you know, suffered prejudice outside in the world, or whatever scenario that has caused you pain and caused you suffering, it is for a reason. And one of the biggest reasons is because it's turning a man in to find out who he is. All of the different adversarial things that have happened in the world, including psychic vampirism, because, again, psychic vampirism is just another kind of violence. It all boils down to different forms of violation on the person. And the world is full of this kind of thing. And we also do it in our own actions. So it's all about trying to, it's basically about the absence of self, that the people of the world have not been addressing who and what they really are. And you can't blame a lot of them because, you see, we're conditioned from day one. If you take a beautiful stallion, you know, but you have, with a whip, and in a closed, fenced environment, you train that animal every hour, on the hour, you know, day after day, week after week, you know, it's going to perform. Mm-hmm. Even the wisest of animals, like the elephant, which is, you know, known as the wisest of all animals, even the lion, which is the most ferocious of all animals, will do your silly damn tricks for you if it's trained, you know, long enough. And the human being is no different. So from the point go, from the, you know, intervention of parents who don't know what's going on, all the way up to the schools and then, you know, further on and through the media, human beings are just pulled, literally taken away and pulled away from their own inner voice, pulled away from their own inner center. And they're living on the periphery of being. And that's a very dangerous place to be, because if you're out of touch with your own sovereignty, if you're out of touch with your own inner voice, then you are open to all the parasitical energies, you know, and all the vampiristic energies that may exist of people who are even further from the light than you are. Then it becomes a vicious circle, because this kind of phenomena does not happen unless there is a violation somewhere. Psychic vampirism, like any kind of violence, is a violation of truth. It happens. It occurs because people are living in absence of moral virtue or of truth.
Yeah.
And until the world returns to a virtuous state, it's not doing that. So you're going to have these kinds of parasitical type of action. And as I said, we all have it to a degree. But you may borrow somebody's energy or take somebody's energy, and it's such a small amount that it's not really missed, and then the chi, builds up again quite quickly. Or we might meet somebody that's a bit of a pain, but they're not necessarily a vampire, but we got to maybe do a couple of things for them. And it kind of, takes our energy down. You'll have a lot of that happen in life. But it doesn't mean that that person is a conscious violator of your energy. It doesn't mean that that person has murdered themselves. It doesn't mean that that person is, very, very far away from the truth and the light, and that they're living, they want you to fulfill their existence. So that it's very different each case. But the remedy is to use your reason, know that the subject is out there, and then start to be able to monitor your own energy levels emotionally, so that you're walking down the street, and you feel good, you feel all right, there's nothing troubling you, you seem to be in an equanimous state. You meet this individual, you talk for about 15 minutes, and then you leave, and then suddenly you find that your emotions are in a terrible state. Most people don't connect the dots. They don't connect the fact that, wait a minute, was it to do with that person and their energy? Because we are trained to blame ourselves. It's a form of self-sadism. We are taught only to look to our own, sort of inner mind and the kind of mood swings that we normally have. And we don't necessarily note the fluctuations of our energy based upon, and the reason why is because we trust the mask.
Yeah.
We go by the mask, and everyone is good at playing the mask. So you meet somebody, and just because they're smiling, and just because they're happy to see you, and because they're, throwing back at us the platitudes, we might not notice what our emotional body is saying. But see, our emotional body is very intelligent, and our subconscious mind is very intelligent, and it knows when it's being, when energy is being stolen. So one of the things we need to do is to sort of think about where we are in our minds and what's our natural state. Who are we, naturally? And then once we really have an understanding of that frequency and we really have a printout of who we are normally just left to our own devices, it becomes a little easier to notice when the needle is swinging, and we can judge what is the influence of other people. But this ultimately means a return to selfhood, because we have been dragged so far away from our own inner, sort of center, from this magnetic north of our own being, that we couldn't even tell if you paid us $1 million what our own energy is, because we don't have our own energy.
Yeah, we deny it.
Yeah, and something, George, it's worse than that. People don't even have their own energy. They live so much with other people. They live for other people, the whole martyr problem, where you're always immersed in the life of other people, you're surrounded by other people, you care, far, far too much for the welfare of other people. You're totally involved in their lifestyles, and you allow them to be overly, involved in yours, because you have no center. You have no sense of self. So people are running around, not just on the weekends when it's kind of obvious to see, but all day long, every day, they're just absolutely open, wide open. It's like the boundaries are down, and everyone is just a flux. This is also what you have with the consensus trance on an intellectual level. And then Carl Jung, talked about the collective unconscious, that even people are just programmed, they have no sense of individuality or uniqueness or selfhood. And therefore, you are then perfect prey to the vampire who knows how to work you, because you have already got three-quarters of the social conditioning as a perfect setup.
You've already done all the work for him.
You've done the work for them. You have a beautiful mansion. Something created and is precious and is pristine. But you the doors are wide open for every derelict to come in and just, make himself happy.
Yeah.
And then you're wondering what the stink is in your life.
Now,
my work is basically to address the fact that, is that psychologists are unable to cure a lot of their patients. Patients are spending tons and tons of money going for years and years and years. And I'm not talking about people who are just shooting the breeze. I'm talking about people who know they have serious problems, are terribly, terribly wounded, having lots and lots of problems, and wasting all their resources trying to resolve what's going on. And then you have the New Age movement, which is also filled with healing techniques, and, again, people are trying every modality, and they're coming away, a lot of them, something is not working, and the therapists are not aware of psychic vampirism, and the psychologists are only barely now starting to get involved with this. And if you're not aware of it, well, the simple fact is you're not going to heal the patient, and the person is not going to get healed. You've got to start understanding that there are these individuals in your life, and they can be causing you tremendous toxicity. If you don't know about it, then you're going to be in a constant state of self-blame, thinking, what's wrong with me? I can't get well. I must be crazy. No, I'm becoming a junkie of these healers. You know, and then you get into all this self-recrimination, and all the time, the answer is around you. It could be the people that you're hanging around with, or the people that are in your life, or even people who have passed on, or people that you maybe don't even know that well doing it to you. There's all sorts of permutations of this. It's not about getting off the hook by saying, oh, yeah, well, you know, this is goes on. I don't have to do any homework. So there's a fine line, but this is a legitimate phenomenon that has been studied, you know, and I want to present it in a true, accurate way, not just like for some book that's on a spinner rack somewhere, another New Age self-help jive book that, you know, is getting people off the hook and not telling them the full story.
Once, let's say, one has had an attack, how do we heal after an attack?
Well, again, you know, it's difficult to say because each individual case is different. Basically, the person has to get centered. What they need to really do is get away immediately. The main problem that I've seen in the lack of healing is because you're emotionally corded to the person already. So if you can decord, that means, you know, emotionally just drop that person and or those people and get away.
Cut the cord.
You're going to be good, you know, and later on you'll come back quickly to your center. Because remember, not everyone is massively attacked. It's not, you know, again, it's one of those situations in which you may have brushed into one and it's pretty easy to recuperate. You know, I deal with extreme circumstances in which people are completely compromised on all levels, materially, you know, sexually, spiritually, emotionally, whatever. And it goes like this, George. When you have an intellectual camaraderie with people, but then for some reason, you know, that kind of breaks down. Say that, you know, you got a bunch of, you know, say you have something in common, like, you know, you believe in vegetarianism, you know, and you're against all the hunters, and you're against the, you know, and you put yourself out there as a kind of an anarchist who's against the system or whatever, and you cluster up and clan up with a bunch of people, and then slowly, you know, you all change and you all differ. You know, it's painful, but it's not that bad to change your intellectual camaraderie. It's like people in a band, you know, who are all playing the same kind of music, but then what do you know? The guy wants to do some kind of different music, and, you know, that feeling of brotherhood breaks. You know, it's painful, but it's not that hard to you know, pull away and detach, take those hooks out of you and go, well, okay, we changed, you know, we moved on. If you have material connections with somebody, like you're in business with them and you're working on this partnership, or you have a business that's with other people, and again, you know, some sort of breach comes in, you know, it can be painful and it can be wrong, but again, you can recuperate quite quickly. But you see, in life, when you make emotional connections with people, especially on a deep level, when you get courted emotionally, it is a totally different matter. For some reason, maybe because of the primitivism of the human being emotionally, these hooks are very, very deep. You've got to imagine them like, you know, real big, you know, fisherman's hooks, you know, something pretty, like anchors that go right into your soul.
Very
right
barbed.
Into the vessels, right into the blood, right into the bone. And so, boy, oh boy, trying to take those out again is very, very hard, if not impossible. And then the problem is that even when you've taken them out, the wounds take a long time to heal, even though the hooks may be out. So this is where the situation is, that, you know, when you've realized, it can be too late, because the person who's normally vampirizing you is usually doesn't present themselves as an enemy. That's not the way the vampire works. The enemy, doing that will be no good, because then your defenses are up. They will act like the most charming, wonderful, you know, graceful and brilliant person, et cetera, and then they will make you get courted to them. This is the very severe ones will do this. They will violate your sovereignty. They'll violate your sexual and emotional and spiritual sovereignty. And therefore, you're more likely that you'll be, you know, emotionally courted to these people. And therefore, it's very difficult to make the break, because we project our own virtue on other people. Which means that we often, when we meet people, if you're good, you project your own goodness on them, you project your own goodness on the world, and you expect everyone to act and be who you like you are. And it comes as a mighty big shock when you realize that people are not even remotely like what you are. They're not even remotely like what you think they are. Because you have an idea in your head that needs to go. Now, that's very hard for people to swallow, because it goes against the grain. You know, and I call it the Hamlet complex. Hamlet was so pure and so moral, so openly moral, so visibly moral, that number one, he was you know, the victim of tremendous violence from the people around him. And more so, he was in a state of absolute torpor, complete and utter depression and malcontentedness, to even realize that people were immoral. So, you know, this is the question. It has to do with how much light you've got is how much, you know, worse vampirism is going to happen to you. It's a strange paradox.
And again, that's why it's so important to know thyself, because that's your biggest and best defense.
Yeah. Even though that might sound very bizarre to most people, and if you're, you know, if you have a predicament going on in your life, that can seem like the worst kind of advice, you know. In fact, it's the best advice. The whole thing is become initiated because the person did not know themselves.
Yeah.
This is how I got into the subject. You know, I come from the spiritual community, and it was through my, you know, it was through the discoveries of metaphysics and knowing thyself that I came across this pernicious disease. Because in my work, it's not so much about finding out how to, you know, develop towards the light. I believe that people already have a tremendous instinct for doing that. I always say this in my work. I think that the problem is not that people lack the passion or the motivation or the inclination to go towards the truth. I think that a lot of people have. I think the reason why we're not there is because we're not addressing those forces that keep us from that. We've lost our catabolic thinking. We've lost our deconstructive model, in which you have to remove the violence, the toxicity, and the filth, and the error in order to move forward naturally. What we've done is we've forgotten about that and say, oh, no, but I'll just pay this person, or I'll just give this person my allegiance, or I'll just follow this technique or this spiritual path, and that will help me. But, you know, that's just trying to pull yourself up by the bootstraps. You don't need any of that stuff. You will already automatically move of your own nature towards your own satori, towards your own nirvana, without anybody else's say-so or help. It's just that you're attached. It's the famous old, you know, story of what the Eastern mystics used to say is attachment, attachment, attachment. But what did they really mean by that? You see, and I'm hoping that my work will give the Western people a much better understanding of what it's meant when they say that, you know, you have to let go of your attachment. People have a very vague understanding about what that means. What they're really talking about is emotional attachments, a particular kind of courting, a particular kind of neediness that's very primal and it's very, very deeply inside human beings towards one another. And it's a violation. Now, we might call it relationship. We might give it the term love because that's easy to do. It's very easy for somebody to cover their psychic violence in the name relationship. If you're not dealing with a human as a human, but you're dealing with them as a role, because that person is your child, your slave, or your husband, or your mother, you know, these are all roles and they have no meaning spiritually whatsoever. Most of these relationships are not based on people dealing with another person as a human, respectfully, you know, and responding to their sovereignty and to their spirituality. You never see that. What you see are various forms of violence, various forms of enslavement under the name of family, you see, under the name of government. Look what's happening right now in America. You know, psychic vampires are all the way up to the White House.
Yeah, and beyond.
And we put them there. You know,
yeah.
I say this in my other work. But the condition is within everybody. You could have a person in your family that's more of a tyrant to you than anybody in Capitol Hill. You've got to deal with the individuals that are psychically, you know, erasing your spiritual quest, holding you back from your light, right in your midst, if you can hope to do anything tomorrow, you know, on a larger scale.
Well, we're going to take our next break here now. I tell you, the time just goes by so quickly. It's just amazing. And when we come back, I want to ask you a question to kind of bring us into the next segment. And the question will be, what's the difference between a creative man and a destructive man?
Okay.
But for now, here is Jethro Tull in War Child. Enjoy. I'm sitting here talking with Michael Tesserian, and right now, once again, about psychic vampirism. And before we left a break there, Michael, I wanted to ask the question, what is the difference between a creative man and a destructive man?
That's a supreme question, a very important question. Goes to the, you know, and it's very important to ask these kinds of questions because there are different kinds of human beings walking around in the earth. And, you know, again, as I was saying, using our reason to not only be able to monitor ourselves, but to, you know, be able to judge other people is very, very important. In the New Age movement, there's this whole cult of thou should, you know, shall not judge, and all of this malarkey, you know, and I'm very, very much against that. I believe that judgment and criticalness are aspects of the reason, and that we're living in an age you know, that is very, very down on things that, you know, we need to be using every single day. I mean, we use them every day at the counter. We use them every day when we're doing normal things, when you're going to buy something. And yet when it comes to the most critical moments of our life, when we're just about to make these critical emotional accordings, we suddenly throw them out the door and believe that, oh, just accept what people, the mask that they play. And we hurt our own, we hurt ourselves by doing that. We actually violate our own judgment. We violate our own intuition when we do this. So there is a need to observe the differences in people and to sharpen the attributes of the reason. Otherwise, we're going to be wide open to attack. But getting specifically to your question, you know, it really boils down to Arno Gruen is a psychologist that I think summed it up perfectly, in which he talked about the difference between the outer-directed and the inner-directed person. This is a psychologist called Arno Gruen, and he's a sort of a Freudian who wrote On the Betrayal of the Self, and he wrote about how it has come that man has basically become a robot, an automaton, a person who just follows the handrails that are provided by the system, by the society, and goes along and performs these roles. And what the psychologists are saying, the Freudians and the post-Freudians are saying, is that, look, most people that you see are actually, George, not even human in the fully sense of the word. They're deeply sick, deeply ill people who will end up on a psychiatrist's bench if they can afford it, or on medication if they can't. We're dealing with a culture of people who have lost their soul. Yeah. And Jung also talked about this, Carl Jung. And the psychosis or the pathology is rooted in this ubiquitous extroversion that you see in the world. So you take the extrovert person. That person is not going to look deranged or psychopathic, because they may apparently be creative. You know, it's like people in music. They can be drug fiends. They can be womanizers. You know, they can be the most debauched of people, but they can get on stage and play great music.
Yeah.
So to all intents and purposes, they appear to be quite normal, and even people might envy those kind of people. So, but they're outer-directed. Outer-directed means that you're waiting for the world to turn you on. You are absolutely empty within, but you are a good mimic, and you're a brilliant performer. So most people that you see around the world, they don't actually have a soul at all, because there's a fundamental rule that people need to understand. And what we're talking about, they can go to my website, Psychic Vampirism, and they can read that quote that you started the show with, and they can get into this a little bit more if they want to. And on the blog, if they go to michaeltesarian.com, they'll be able to go through the blog and read up on this so they can get a handle on what we're talking about. But fundamentally, psychologists have understood that the soul is not something that you're born with. The soul is something that you yourself create as you live with this thing we call experience. That's what it is. That's what experience is for. The theater is time and space. And your will, your energy, your passion creates that which is meaning in your life. But my God, how threatening that is to the man of ego, or the man who's been mistrained from the time that he's born.
Yeah.
He has no intention of giving meaning to his own life. He's waiting for George Bush to give him meaning.
Yeah.
He's waiting for the media to do it. He's waiting for the neighbor to do it and the lover to do it. In fact, he's hot after a wife, so he can get joined at the hip and have those children and get into that whole world, because he himself is empty, and he's saying, fill me, people. Now, he'll use the word love every 5 minutes if you give him a chance. And he'll, you know, use the word patriotism and individuality and independence, because they're performing. They know all the right songs, all the right, you know, cues and affectations. But those people are fundamentally empty, and they're saying to other people, you fill me up. Making slaves of their wives and husbands, slaves of their children, slaves of their animals, and slaves of everybody they meet at work, and so on and so forth. The creative person is the inner-directed person. Who can live in the world and enjoy the stimuli? It's not that you become a hermit or a monk. No, he can enjoy the movies and the music and the larks and the fun and all that the world has to offer. But he is not empty should that stuff not cease to exist.
It doesn't guide him.
He has an inner life, an inner enriched place, that just, you know, works.
Yeah.
He's able to manufacture and create for himself what is needed. Culture, civilizations at one time were able to do that. Long before the time of, you know, the entertainment industry, people performed, people dressed up, people did mimicry, people did puppet shows, people composed music, you see. People sat around the fire and told stories. They entertained one another. They entertained each other. The individual must have an inner life.
Yeah.
That person is much less likely to be vampirized. You know, he's going to be heavily vampirized, but he's a person who is full of his own enrichment. Now, the psychologists have discovered that of the two kinds of person, the extrovert or the introverted kind of person, the extroverted people are the easiest to hypnotize by far. So what does that tell us? It tells us, for one thing, not that extroversion itself is bad, but the ubiquitously, you know, extrovert person is already under hypnosis. He's already a person who's bought into a lie, bought into the collectivized stuff, which is the fashions, which is this maniacal, you know, the fashion statement is one thing, is one version of this. It's not the only one. So it's not like, you know, you have to blame people who are into fashions. But fashion is one aspect of the consensus, that you have no sense of self whatsoever, that you've got to be, you know, what the world is telling you and what the media, you know, is throwing at you.
Mm-hmm.
But it goes way deeper than that. And therefore, the person who is inventive, yeah, they are these extroverted people who know how to jump through the hoops. It's exactly the same thing you get in the academic world, the people who jump through all the hoops that the state provides and say, well, now I got a PhD, I must know things.
Yeah, can regurgitate well.
Yeah, but I must be intelligent, because look, they've given me my medal. They pinned me, they pinned a medal on me. They told me I'm a PhD. I must actually know something.
Yeah, I have all these letters after my name.
That's it. And yet they know nothing. There's not even a single creative person amongst most of them. And they're not mavericks. In fact, they'll go after the mavericks. Those people now believe that they're the academic police who are going to tell the Emmanuel Velikovskys and the Dr. Wilhelm Reichs that they don't matter. You see, so we have this kind of tyranny going on in our world.
Yeah.
The creative person, you know, he's completely different creature. Completely different creature. He's inner-directed. He's not waiting for the stimulus to turn us on. And he's not playing a role. He's not performing. In fact, he actually refuses to perform. He's something of a rebel.
Yeah.
He tries to not conform to any kind of pattern whatsoever and gets very upset when you try to, you know, compel him to do so. That person is a truly creative person, even if he doesn't produce anything.
He himself
is a creative person.
He's alive.
Well, yeah, he's alive. And most likely he will create things, amazing things. But you see, he will be an outsider. He will be the person who is the outsider because he's on the journey of looking for the truth of himself. The person who's conforming to the handrails of the world and to the conveyor belt and who's, you know, basically has basically given up being a true person, being a true individual, given up finding out who they are, this individual will be automatic. And it will be the media and society and the government and all the rest of it that provide the scaffolding for the security that is required in that person. And this is what is happening all over the world today.
Yeah.
And that's why then people can turn around and lament that they don't have Bachs and Beethovens anymore and, you know, Rembrandts anymore. Well, actually, we do. It's just that, you know, you don't appreciate them and you crush them whenever they should show their spirit.
Yeah.
Whenever they try to act individually, you shoot them down.
Yeah, you want to stop them, you want to get rid of them because they're not following what everyone else is doing.
That's right. And we don't even give them the breathing space to then maybe develop. You know, one of the greatest adversaries in our world is time, the way that time is manipulated. And the way time is managed. The people don't even have a moment now to even finish a thought. They don't even have a moment to finish a sentence before they're being cut off by some other jerk sitting there, you know, claiming to be a friend.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody even knows how to listen to another person anymore. And because we're in a culture of that, where it's perpetual, I mean, absolutely wall-to-wall, perpetual, how then can a person follow their own thoughts if they're not permitted by their friends to do so? So it's so deadly. Absolutely creates epidemics.
It's a vicious cycle.
People who have not even got the length of duration from one thought to the next, George, because the media has already jumped in there, or your friends are just wanting to cut off and blab what their life is about, and nobody listens anymore. And I found that, you know, if you observe this, people don't even have the luxury anymore of even finishing a thought. What can you do with a culture who thinks that the time between two thoughts is too long?
Yeah, yeah. Well said.
Incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I tell you, and you've just defined a very limited number of people, unfortunately.
Yeah, but you know you can turn it around because again, people will change when times get hot.
Yeah.
So even as much as the you know trouble that happens in society, or you know, it seems that the all is woe. I don't know. It's a strange quirk of human fate that they only change when, you know, their ass is on fire. So, you know, and sometimes I look at the, you know, the darknesses in the world and I don't complain about it because I say, look, when everything's going rosy because people have more, better food than they've ever had, They got the greatest kind of technology. They have more freedom than they've ever had in the ages of the past. They have more leisure time. They have more perks. People can travel. They can see the world. My goodness, if you compare our world just to the agricultural or industrial revolution, we have so much laid on, it's unbelievable. More privilege. And yet, you know, yeah, three-quarters of the world is still starving.
Hmm.
You know, there's youth, there's young children even in America who are starving. So there's problems, but you also have to look at the positive side of it to say, well, we need to really then use the positive privileges that we've got for the absolute best that we can do. Because, you know, our forefathers didn't even have that. So things can turn around, but it just seems that until times get really tough for some reason, the human being does not value, you know, because they've had the greatest music. You just played Jethro Tull, you know, I couldn't survive it without listening to bands like that and that kind of music. You know, people have had the greatest music, they've had the finest movies, they've had the finest books, they've had the greatest, columnists. You've had Lord of the Rings, you know, I mean, is there something out there that hasn't already told people the greatest stories, the greatest mysteries, the greatest myths? You know, the whole story of virtue. I mean, we're talking about psychic vampirism. What was Professor Tolkien talking about of the Dark Lord, you know, where he literally has to give you a ring so that he can suck you dry of all your life force?
Uh-huh.
Look at poor Gollum, you know. People are familiar with the story. Sucked dry of his energy until he becomes basically a shadow. You know, so tell me where it is that we have not been taught. In the greatest songs, in the greatest, you know, the tradition is there. It's all in your face. Fundamentally, there's certain people who just will not face it.
Yeah, and it's so easy, too. All you got to do is stop and listen.
And stop and listen. But, you know, again, it doesn't happen until there's trauma and pain in life. You know, Schopenhauer said, without pain, life is meaningless. And as much as you want to, you know, rebel against statements like that, people prove it every day.
Yeah.
Until trauma or pain comes into their life, until the universe visits adversarial energy on you, you don't get down to what is fundamental. And I wish it wasn't like that, but it is. Unfortunately, it is that people only, you know, they will not wake up without a shock, without some trauma. And now, you know, you can manifest that trauma even on the social level. You can hire politicians to go out and murder in your name, you know, if that makes you happy. If your whole inner violence, your violence towards yourself is so severe, then, of course, then we enter into this whole situation in which we have the nemesis, the shadow in the world, you know, and the whole guilt complex that's operating in people that keeps them in these inauthentic lifestyles. So the human being needs a radical change of their psychology, and I believe those days are coming. I believe that they're not going to get away with it because nature has its own purity, its own methodology for waking people up.
Yeah, I've often thought that no matter what we do, Mother Earth will, you know, kick us in the butt when it's so needed.
You know, even if you get into the science of it, Bruce Lipton, you know, 99-point-something-something is our unconscious mind. The little part that we use that causes all our problems, it's only the smallest part of ourselves. So we have another brain, another mind that is tapped in, you know, to the universal matrix. And despite our own conscious, egoistic, you know, violating life, there is something else within us that is connected to the truth and desires balance and is screaming in pain because the conscious mind is not aligning with the truth and is not being virtuous. Well, there's a whole part of ourselves that's in disaffection because of that. Human beings need to get off the medication, you know, stop escaping, stop running to the fashions and all of this stuff, and face themselves within and say that I'm going to put down all of these roles and this nonsense of the performance because that is not helping me. It's condemning me to further agony, and it's condemning the world. So, you know, to hell with all of these addictions and this medication, which, of course, also then helps these leviathans, these monopolies, stay in existence. You know, and people need to start turning to face themselves, because if they don't, we might be in the end of the civilizations that, you know, people think have been created.
You know, this is something I wanted to ask you too, and this may be skipping ahead a whole lot, but I want to ask it before I forget. I've often thought that what's going on, especially in the States and to an extent maybe the UK too, that and here in Canada too. That this whole thing that's going on now, this Illuminati or whatever one wants to call it, they're in their death throes. That's my belief. Do you agree with that, or do you think it's just, you know, they're doing their thing?
No, I very much believe that. You see, I believe that the kind of evil that we have got in our world is a fairly recent historical phenomenon. Because our own lives are so short, we kind of think, you know, this is an eternal problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's not. And evil has an agenda. And it, again, it's rooted in our unconscious, but say for a moment we just want to keep it sort of political and not observe the psychological aspect for a moment. You know, in my work, I talk about the origins of the kind of people who rule from behind the throne. And I very much talk about the end date of 2012. And we're actually in a countdown situation to that now, from the beginning of 2007. And so it's interesting that we're doing this talk right now, because 2007's opening is a very, very important date,
yep,
astrologically and astronomically, to the countdown. And it's going to be a twofold type of thing. As these darker forces start to have to deal with who they are and come to their denouement, the human race will have a greater opportunity to find out all the things that have been hidden from it. So it's both constructive and destructive. There is going to be a greater chance to find out, if people have the curiosity and people have the interest, this is the time where they're going to have some of the big questions answered for them. And it's going to happen easily, and it's going to happen naturally. If people can apply their, you know, mind to it, they're going to have incredible revelations that centuries after centuries after centuries of human people did not have and could never have had these revelations that are about to come now. We're living in what the Maya priests called the time of apocalypse, which just means unveiling, revealing.
A new beginning.
A new beginning.
Yeah.
But the other side of that is that the word apocalypse meant a lid or a covering, a leather covering, and it really refers to the human persona. It really refers to the human mask. And when these masks are starting to come down, individuals are going to start showing who they really are. This is going to happen from the, you know, level of ordinary relationships all the way up to the government, all the way up to the corridors of power. And individuals don't want the mask to slip. It's not that they're willingly doing this. It's going to be forces of a kind of energy, a light, that's coming in to expose this kind of thing. It's kind of a dark light. It's governed by the planet Pluto and by Scorpionic and Aquarian Uranian power, if you get into the astrological jargon of it. It's also created, it's psychologically, it's to do with the shadow personality and the projections that people have. So individuals are not wanting their masks to slip. In fact, they're benefiting from having those masks. They can get away with murder. But there's some force that's going to come and try to take away those masks. And that is going to be a massive exposure for a lot of people. It will also expose all the corruption that is on the governmental level, as you were talking about. And so those forces are going to have to deal with it. And because of the unveiling of this kind of, you know, disease, there is a good chance then that the human race can rid itself of this, you know, type of life that we've created, type of leaders or misleaders, and we can start again afresh from 2012. Given what the prophets are saying about 2012, and given the way that it was expressed, it looks like that it really will be a major change, a major leveling. It's not going to be just a little phase shift at that particular date. It could be a very, very radical, massive, worldwide change, you know, and if the dark forces have their way. You see, the trouble with evil, and you people have seen this in Star Wars and in Star Trek, is that a being can get so evil that they'd rather go down and take everybody with them if they knew they had to expire themselves.
Yeah, that's the scary part.
Right, and they may not even be in control of that kind of instinct, because it is an instinct. It's a death instinct. I mean, for years and years and years, people thought that, you know, people had their hand on the button and could just press it and the nuclear war would begin. Well, it's along those lines. If you're so psychopathic and so megalomaniac, you know, my mind goes to the Star Trek 3 movie, or I think it was Star Trek 2, The Wrath of Khan or whatever,
mm-hmm.
where this kind of creature wants to blow up the whole universe just because he's got to die. Which means, hey, chump, you go and kill yourself. The world will be rid of you. But what the problem is that we don't understand that these people are very, very megalomaniacal and highly, you know, evil. They basically, you know, this is the fact of the matter. And you see, how do we know that they tomorrow will not, you know, take away more and more of our rights? How do you know that tomorrow they will not unleash a kind of a plague? You know, how do you know that they won't infect the whole human race and then say, hey, we're going to give you here's a kind of an AIDS type of thing that's going around, and so many people have caught this, and we're going to hand you the antidote, but you got to, you know, do what we say in order to get it. You know, whatever. There's so many different scenarios that could happen.
Yeah.
Or it could be a third world war in which they're going crazy. You know, countries, Iraq, it's not just a question of oil that is needed. Water is a big problem.
That's going to be the big thing now, is water.
Right, the water. So, you know, and then we've got predictions about America running out of its oil and the whole changeover of these, you know, kind of fossil fuels, you see. So we're living in a time where there's a feeling of great insecurity upstairs in the corridors of power for whatever reason. But this was predicted years ago, even in the movie, you know, 3 Days of the Condor. My mind goes to think of that movie, in which the whole theme of that movie is about planning a war, going through the role, a war game, in order to get ready for the real war that might be happening. A CIA within the CIA, you see? So we've already been told, we've already been shown. But it's just like the normal insecurity that a person has when there's a job loss, or when, how are we going to pay the next, how are we going to pay our rent, or where's the next food going to come from? You see, individuals have this trauma on their individual private life, where there's a major upset or a trauma or a death or a robbery. Well, you're not acting in the same way. You're totally in panic. You don't even sleep. Everybody is infected by the, you know, the panic. Mm-hmm. Well, you imagine that insecurity multiplied many, many, many times up on the government level there. Anything's justified to them. Murdering and slaughtering the whole, you know, the whole world is perfectly justifiable now.
Yeah.
Because individuals are living out of connection with the natural order. The nature will provide all everything. There's geniuses in our midst that can use free energy devices. I laugh at these people who are trying to, you know, joke about, they're not joking, they're serious about, you know, the ending of fossil fuels, and they're nearly pulling their hair out over that. What are you talking about? Henry T. Moray, Nikola Tesla? These guys were able to run entire office blocks on a box that wasn't even plugged in.
Well, look at the human body. Even the human body itself, we have enough electrical current going through us that we can harness
that. Isn't
that
amazing?
Yeah.
You've had Walter Russell, you're going blue in the face. You've got, you know, you've had the finest genes, but nobody's interested in them. That's all woo-woo stuff. Forget about that. No, we got to dig up the earth and corrupt the earth and find other ways, and we got to monopolize. Because believe me, also, I can tell you one thing. There is more oil that the American government has got hidden for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. There's no such thing as an energy shortage whatsoever, even in oil. Anyone who's done 5 minutes of real homework knows that. You know, I've known people who've worked in the top oil companies who've been taken into secret rooms and shown all the hidden silos and all the hidden oil that's kept in reserve while they show shortages in the world so that the whole world can go into panic.
Well, they want you to believe that.
That's right. It's all mind control. So even if people are into the oil thing, do some homework and find out about the black operations and the fact that they've got so much oil, so much. If they weren't polluting everywhere, you'd have even more. So, you know, the situation is completely manufactured. Manufactured fear, manufactured lack, manufactured want. There's not a single country in the world that should be starving, but the World Bank sure makes sure that they starve. So, I mean, you know, we got injustices on our doorstep, and it's completely obvious to anyone who's done 5 minutes of homework that the whole thing is organized. You know, and we've had people, not just people like myself, who are not scientists. We've had the scientists from the top of the totem pole telling you this, proving it.
Yeah.
You know, Dr. Dale Scott from Berkeley, and so many other great scientists who've gone to the heart of these matters.
Yeah.
You know, from Canada to Malaysia.
Dr. David Suzuki up here.
Who absolutely confirmed this. Yeah. Noam Chomsky. You name it. The list is endless of the people at the highest level of the academic totem pole. And yet still people don't get it.
And I mean, it's out there for, it's out there in the open for all to
absolutely.
See.
Absolutely. Out there in the open, you know. So this is the situation in which the human needs to open their minds and really, you know, feel good about it. Enjoy it.
Yeah.
The discovery of different aspects of the self, the discovery of greater phenomena materially, the adventure of discovering new political ways in which to exist. People can go to my blog. They can go to the future, Mankind's Future page of the blog, and I've got a whole bunch of links there to permaculture and ecology. You know, why not make it an adventure?
Exactly.
Why not make it a big adventure to find out how to live even in your own house?
And
off of better ways. You know, there's been movies made like Affluenza and All Stressed Up. These are PBS, you know, 1 hour, 2 hour documentaries showing people, you know, different paradigms of how to live on recycled stuff. You know, so there's a whole study in this, and it's a wonderful study to realize that you're not exploiting the earth anymore, and you're not exploiting your neighbors. You know, talking about independence and we're the greatest country and we're all individualistic, it's all just verbiage. It doesn't mean anything.
It's all rhetoric.
Why not do something physically to get off the grid?
Yeah.
Stop, you know, funding these monopolies that are destroying your country.
Exactly. I tell you, I hate living in a city right now. You know, I'm used to living in BC and halfway up a mountain, and It's scary to be in a city nowadays. It's just, you know, when the shit hits the fan, I know a cave where I'm heading to in BC, and I tell you, I miss
cities
those
are geopathic places to begin with.
Yeah.
They're also concrete vampires. You know, the whole idea of creating things in a block, I mean, we can get into the whole geometry of it. Cities are not healthy places to be in any sense of the word.
No, I tell you, I had a teepee for a number of years, and I lived in a teepee for almost a year. And after being in that, I found it so difficult to walk into square buildings. It just assailed my senses. It was so bizarre. I couldn't go into stores. I had to kind of acclimatize my body again to walk into buildings.
Yeah.
It was bizarre.
But, you know, and yet there's a whole culture of domes out there.
Yeah.
People can get into domes, the geodesic domes, and live in those. You know, and they're not expensive. They're far cheaper than even anything to run a normal house. Yeah. Because there's nothing economical about living in 90-degree angles and boxes and squares and cubes, you know, which is ad infinitum. So people need to start, you know, the discovery of self is also an involvement into subjects like feng shui, into subjects like astrology and geomancy. There's a whole world of learning out there that your teachers did not teach you, you know, that you need to re-educate yourselves. People need to educate themselves into all of these different things and make it a joy, make it a discovery, not something horrible and pessimistic and fear-based.
Yeah.
The fear is basically an epiphenomena of the city. Your fear is your epiphenomena of living amongst other people who are living in their lower chakras and are lost in fear. So, you know, stop blaming yourself. I mean, people need to stop blaming themselves. I'm not, when I say you, I don't mean you personally, George. I'm saying you, the people of the world, need to get out of blame and realize there are reasons for your predicament.
Yeah.
You know, you have imbibed the collective. You've projected your own goodness onto others who do not deserve it. It's like, take a relationship setting. You know, one of the greatest psychologists is the late R.D. Lang from Scotland. And Lang said something fantastic. You know, he really analyzed relationships a lot. He said, look, you enter into a relationship and you have given love and you have given trust. Because love and trust go together, and you can say which one's even more important. You know, it's up to you, because both are extremely important, love and trust. He said, yeah, you've entered into the relationship and you're given your wife love and trust, but you do a third thing, which you should not do. And these psychologists know that you shouldn't do it, because they're picking up the pieces of the people who have done it, down the line. He said, you've also done a third thing, and that is that you have expected or conditioned yourself to believe that you're receiving love and trust also. It goes with it. They all come together. If you give your love and trust, you automatically assume, and there's really no reason to do it, but you do, you assume that you're receiving those things in kind without testing for it. And he goes, that is that place of disaster. Because if the vampire is operating in your life, then they are going to make hay out of the fact that you believe you're receiving what you're not receiving. But the problem is not the vampire. The problem is your own assumption. So earlier when you said, how do you protect yourself against the vampire, is know your own motives, know your own assumption. It's actually you who's allowing them into your power.
Yeah, don't assume.
Yeah, he says, in that assumption, you've left yourself wide open to this person who normally probably couldn't attack you. And then what you do, you give so much allowance to those individuals. They breach your sovereignty continually, but because you're in auto-hypnosis, you're constantly forgiving them, you're constantly violating your own intuition, you're constantly letting them get away with murder. When in fact, by the third time they violated you, you should have already been sharp and go, wait a minute, there's something fundamentally wrong here. But you see, we constantly then excuse, because we are in a state of violating our own inner garden, our own inner temple. And then you can't. Why do you then blame the person for bringing their muddy boot prints into your mansion? It's your fault.
Yeah.
Everything precious has a guard around it. You don't go into museums and just see Ming vases, you know, just set down there in front of everybody. Right? They got guards. They got ropes. You know, everything is cordoned off so that you can't just go and stick your fingers on it. Well, individual, the person is the most sacred thing that's walking the planet, but he acts in the most unsacred of ways.
Yeah. Destroying the
and
temple.
And the cities in which they live, people live, is exactly an extension of that Merkaba. It's an extension of the human, of this ego-based regularity, because everyone's so damn insecure inside their own consciousness that they require even the houses in which they live and the streets in which they go and the blocks and everything to be regular. What does that tell you about the psychopathology of people? That they can't even live in an organic, natural way like the tribal ways that they have before, you see? Mm-hmm. It's horrendous. Well, and then from the water and the food,
yeah, you
know, and the media. Oh, this is you know, highly inauthentic ways of living.
Yeah. You know, it's like such a dual-edged sword because it's such an interesting time to be alive, and yet at the same time, it's sometimes such a sad time to be alive.
So this is testing our mettle. You see, the adversarial energy is probably stronger now. And remember, the adversarial energy has been strong always.
Yeah.
But it shifts. It doesn't remain the same. You know, before hundreds of years ago or not too long ago, the adversarial energy was literally a physicalized thing in which it prevented you from even moving 10 miles from your village. It was very, very, very physicalized. You were a serf, you know, and if you wanted to marry somebody, you had to go in front of the Lord, get down on your knees, and beg that person to allow you the privilege of marrying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was crown or it was gown. It was autocracy or it was, theology, whatever you want to call it, monarchy and the religion. Very punitive. Okay, so that kind of changes or lightens up. But we have, other forms of dictatorship, other forms of control. And the controllers have always preferred that we control or police or monitor ourselves because they actually prefer not to do it.
Oh, for sure. They don't have to get their hands dirty.
That's right. And also, there's a lot of people in the world. So, you know, it's better if they embody Big Brother.
Mm-hmm.
And in America, that's what you're finding, is that people are so voyeuristic. People are monitoring each other. People are so intractable. You know, they want three forms of identification just to rent a video.
God.
You know, the whole feeling of camaraderie. I mean, everyone uses the word community. It makes me want to vomit.
Yeah.
That people are so duplicitous. You'd be throwing around the word like community, and the thing doesn't even exist. Private, beautiful private businesses are put out of business.
Oh, for the
in
big
place
ones.
Of huge, meaningless, empty franchises.
Yeah.
And you're telling me that's community? Benches are taken out of parks. There's 101 signs saying don't do this, thou shalt not, don't sit here, don't move there, don't park here.
Yeah, don't step on the grass.
You go.
Don't step on the grass.
Yeah, and yet they're telling us that we have community. Homeless people are walking the streets with nobody caring for them. You know, what on earth are they talking about? Crime is rampant everywhere. You can tell me that you now have a healthy sense of community with all this pernicious stuff going on. I mean, what kind of, you know, mind control are people under? So the city is not going to work because the city was never meant to work. The city is a violation of nature.
Well, and
okay, so accept it, move on.
Yeah.
Let people create new types of communities. Human beings are capable of doing the most remarkable things. So when you see things decaying, don't always think that that's a negative thing. Don't always interpret that negatively. So when, you know, like you said earlier, that you see, you know, you it's a fine line between wanting to be alive, but seeing all of this adversity. It can help people a lot. Instead of seeing it as adversity, see it as the decline of something that never should have been in the first place. I've said this a lot, and I've got so much flack for saying it, that if a thing is being destroyed, it probably shouldn't have been in existence in the first place. People refuse to understand the philosophy behind that.
Otherwise, it wouldn't be destroyed.
That's right. So if it can be destroyed or broken, it probably should be. It's a different kind of Zen thinking, though, which the West is unfortunately not familiar with.
Yeah.
They can observe that particular kind of understanding. It takes a certain kind of mentality to understand this, that the thing that you're clinging to, the thing that you've been pouring your energy into, the thing that you may be voting into existence, you know, shouldn't have existed from day one. So now, if it's coming to the end of its life cycle, hey, let it go. You'll be better off for it. But this kind of detachment, this kind of catharsis, this kind of divestiture, and this kind of letting go is highly, you know, irregular to these acquisitive, grabbing, greedy, you know, materialistic, narcissistic culture that we find ourselves in today. And, you know, this is where the problems arise.
Yeah. Well, aren't cities really the last place that a civilization ends before it implodes?
Yeah. And, you know, my work goes into that a lot, about that there is civilizations, in fact, do not continue. You know, you may think going down to the mall and it's going to be there forever and it's just so wonderful to drive in your SUV. Well, I got news for you. That's what the Romans thought and the Greeks, you know, and the Israelites, and that's what the Egyptians thought, and that's what the high cultures of India thought. You know, there's been plenty of civilizations that have thought that way. The Maya say that they saw four creations come and go, not civilizations. Four creations come and go. So, you know, yeah, there's nothing permanent about civilization. What's permanent is virtue and truth.
Yes.
But humanity, may come and go. So, you know, and, you know, the powers of deconstruction, they're pretty ruthless when they have to come in to deal with a toxic situation. People might be very shocked about how ruthless those storms can be. So people have to have their own act very much, you know, together in order to withstand this. And it just means that people can stay in the roles, but at least you've got to know that they're roles. You've got to discern between the role and yourself. Nobody's telling anyone to stop, you know, living in playing the roles of mother, father, brother, sister, you know, lover, boss, whatever. All of that can go on, but people need to separate and realize, okay, those are roles that I play, but there's the real me.
Yeah, that doesn't...
And I prefer to have friends that deal with the real me and not with the roles, and I prefer also to deal with people also as individuals.
Exactly.
And try to recultivate this human-to-human connection as opposed to the role-to-the-role connection, because there's nothing but pain and suffering and slavery involved in those roles.
Well,
they're inauthentic. They don't matter.
Exactly. It's an illusion.
Children can be wiser than their parents, but the parent is thinking, oh, no, I'm the boss. I'm the smart ass.
It's a kid's teaching them.
The teachers can be stupider than the pupils.
Well,
politicians can be more immoral and corrupt, you know, than the people who are voting them in. So, the role means nothing.
Yeah.
It has no spiritual value or currency whatsoever. It's utterly fictitious. It's just like performing poodles. There's no meaning whatsoever.
Yeah.
None of these people, you know, are arranged in a hierarchy. The ancient civilizations and many even of the third world cultures before they were completely destroyed and decimated lived in a holarchic situation, not a hierarchy, a holarchy. Everything was based on the sphere. Everything was based on wholeness from, the tribal level onwards to the whole relationship to nature, the way everything was arranged. But, you know, down through the centuries, the shamanic masters have all been removed purposely because those were the doctors of society. They were the healers and they were the detoxers and they were the people who kept out the parasites. They were able to notice the parasitical energy. Again, just very much like Professor Tolkien's movie has been, his book was made into a movie. People check out that movie. You can see a very good example of how ancient societies worked, in which you had the shaman, and that the shamans eventually got corrupted. The wizards got corrupted, and this caused enormous upset in society. But at one point, they were connected to the, knowledge of nature and could assist and monitor and help civilization in a very, very beautiful and natural, organic way. Not as teachers, telling you anything or lecturing you, but helping you to learn yourself, helping to bring the teaching out from the human heart and the human mind.
Yeah, coming to that understanding within.
Yeah, coming to the within, not didactically, which is the way we're forced to do it now, basically imprisoned in these schools for 18 years. I mean, just think about it.
Yeah.
Over here, you even had to, in Europe, you had to wear a uniform. And look at the word uniform. They're teaching you to be individuals, and then the very term uniform. I mean, what kind of nonsense? The thing is so hypocritical and double speak oriented. How can you then develop children who have free thought? Not to mention the fact that in Europe here, the schools that I went to, they were also very violent. They were physically abusive, literally, beat the hell out of you for the slightest infraction.
Yeah. We had that too when I grew up and went to school. We had to strap, and the teachers that threw the balls at your head and whacked you into lockers and.
Oh yeah, full out violence, full out assaulting on your person, whether or not your parents allowed it or not. They were going to do it anyway. Which is, again, the whole point of sadism. You have sadistic people who are sadistic to themselves, then they're going to naturally perform sadistically.
Like you mentioned before, they've lost their humanness.
And
they're no longer human. And that was right. One thing, too, that I saw on one of your videos last night, too. And you're the only other person other than myself that's really picked up on this that I know of personally. I'm sure they're out there, but I haven't talked to them specifically. But in reading of Frank Herbert's Dune, I remember when I was, a teenager, and there was a little saying in his books that I carried with me from the moment I read them. And you're going to know which exactly one it is, and it is, fear is the mind killer.
Yeah.
And I just can't believe that people who read those books didn't come out with that one, because it is so blatantly obvious and so apropos, for today and for any time. But, fear is the mind killer.
Yeah. And people don't notice it or its effects, because, again, they've been moved so far away from the center that they're so far removed from their own authentic voice, that they're basically mutilated. They're emotionally mutilated, and they're on the periphery of being in a very, very precarious place. And therefore, there's a lot to be fearful about. You know, the person who's estranged from their own inner tabernacle, Jesus, you know, they're going to be the recipient of every kind of pathogenic entity or force that, you know, plagues the human mind, because they're in a shattered, fragmented, and broken state. And in that state, there's going to be a lot of anxiety. Because remember, anxiety and fear are two different things.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, it's not fear that is the mind killer, it's anxiety. Because fear is usually, to be technical about it, fear is a emotion that arises when there's a legitimate threat. Like somebody's breaking into your house, you see, or breaking into your car, or somebody's going to try and mug you in the streets or whatever.
Yeah, there is
or, you know, you're going to be attacked.
There is a healthy component to it.
Yeah. Anxiety, though, which we use the word fear to also use that word, but anxiety is fear of something within your own being. And in Dune, this is what the teachings of the, you know, the princely child, the Kwisatz Haderach, that's what the initiations were.
Mm-hmm.
Is a, you know, especially with the some of the rites that he had to go through, was to confront the fear within his own self when it's not really a legitimate threat. And we are in the same situation, that the human being has so estranged themselves from their own dark side. And I don't mean something negative. The dark side is actually something positive. It's an aspect of ourselves
that
we have, you know, thrown aside.
Yeah.
And we have not, we're not connected to looking at our own self. This then creates this estrangement, and all of the repressed content, we get anxiety about it. So it's about something of ourselves inside that we fear, that we are in lack of, and that we're in denial of. And this, over time, builds up this sense of anxiety. And so we have this culture of stress. And then we have the next culture that tries to deal with the stress, meaning the medical, pharmaceutical. Okay, yeah, everybody's stressed. Okay, so let's rearrange the furniture now on the Titanic, and let's have some more medication, and let's have some more yoga, and let's do a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and maybe let's change the work hours a bit, and can you breathe a little bit more deeply, you know, and all this nonsense, all this superficial topical stuff, anything to avoid the true Freudian, you know, true full psychological analysis of what the hell is really going on. So I'm not a believer in any of these gimmicks and topical, you know, kind of scenarios, because, you know, that just prolongs the problem. And human beings are going to really have to take responsibility. There's no easy way. You're going to have to take responsibility. But I claim that, you see, that this is incredibly enjoyable. When you're discovering the mystery of the self, when you're studying the masters, when you're really learning about the mind and what the mind is, what the brain is, what ancestral thought is, you know, it's a tremendously revealing thing.
Yeah,
it's totally. Like the individual who is diagnosed with cancer or a person in their family, and I know many, many examples of this because it was very, very affiliated with the holistic movement in America, that, you know, a family member or a parent gets cancer, and, you know, 4 or 5 years down the line, and sometimes even shorter, when the son or the mother or the family members who've been running and studying the holistic thing, they will turn to you and say it's been the biggest revelations of their life, even though it was born from a trauma and there was a panic, by them learning about herbs and by them learning about the right kind of eating and the, you know, aromatherapy and reflexology, they have completely transformed as people.
Yeah,
it's they are more educated than the doctors who were diagnosing them in the first place.
Yeah, it's a true
this
awakening.
This is what I mean. See it as an adventure.
Yeah.
You know, adventure is not just marching off, you know, the Mount Shasta and climbing up the mountain. You know, there's other kind of euphoria than just physical things. You should do those too, but there's also intellectual pursuits, spiritual pursuits that are can bring you tremendous knowledge and tremendous enjoyment of a kind that most unawakened people, you know, they don't have. They might want to run and swat tennis balls, and they might want to run and, you know, roller skate, or they want to climb mountains or do with all this physical stuff, and their lives are basically empty. Because they're filling their days with the constant stimulus of a world that's just going to be there 10,000 years, you know, later after they're dead and gone.
Yeah.
But they've never really, you know, moved to develop the thing called life, the life force, the soul, the spirit.
No, and it's not they're not eating the proper food to feed the soul.
Yep.
And that's exactly.
And then unfortunately, this is, you know, again, the condition of the training. Parents who are just not smart enough or clever enough or willful enough to put their children into better schools. They just send them right down the block to these cages, to these utterly preposterous mind control factories, you know, and then they'll happily tell you that they were brought up in the 60s and listened to the Moody Blues and they listened to Pink Floyd. And I just go, knock, knock, knock. How can you be telling me that?
Yeah.
That you grew up on all this music and all this incredible movie making and spiritualism and for what it was worth. And then you actually, you tell me that you're living in suburbia, you're living in a box, and you have the audacity that you feed, you know, this cereal and this toxic meat, toxic milk to your children, and then you're sending them off down the block to these schools, and then you're laughingly telling me, hey, look at my photographs when I had my tie-dye on. And you're telling me there's no such thing as hypocrisy or injustice in the world. You're a living example of it.
Yeah, we like to call them the weekend warriors.
That's right. And it's the same all over the place. Because this is the ego. This is, again, as I was saying, the performance, the hoop jumping. Oh, yeah, I got my 2-3 years, you know, to just let loose. So I'll dabble. And the New Age movement and the conspiracy movement, you're full of dabblers.
Yeah.
You know, okay, come and dabble, but, you know, can you persist, find out, discover, you know, make it a life passion? Well, you don't have that. What you have is total, utter dabblers. And you know how many of these people I've met in my life who for like 2 years or 18 months, you know, they'll get into what you're doing and they'll read up on it and they'll browse it. And then when it becomes too hot to handle, when they realize, oh, Jesus, this is really something that's going to open my eyes and cause me to really breathe deeply and discover, you know, that I can be empowered now. But it means that I have to leave the role and I have to leave the carnival and I have to detach from all this nonsense. Then you don't see them for love nor money. They scarper as fast as they can get in. They run right back into the matrix, right back into the lie.
Yeah, well, who wants to be responsible for themselves, right?
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. There's so much more. And the time goes by so quick. Before we do head out here, though, I guess you've kind of already said it, but just for those that are maybe just haven't heard it or maybe need to hear it again, tell us what 2012 is bringing us.
Well, you know, again, it'll be a different experience for each person. But on a general way, the key thing is now that the key component to remember is that we're going to start being able to see behind the mask. And that means a different reality for both protagonist and antagonist. It does mean that there will be political, because, you know, these kinds of effects are going to be felt on all the levels, both political, social, relational, domestic, you name it. So it depends what, you know, milieu we're addressing. If I'm talking about 2012 in relationship to relationships or the domestic situation, you know, or like on my DVD with 2012, that's why it's so long. It's like 5 discs long. We try to explore all the different permutations of this. On the political level, I mean, a blind man can see that there's revelations taking place already. Things are massively changing. To put it in a nutshell, America has always been an aristocracy. It's just that now you're finding out. So there's one example of the mask coming down. The mask is coming down to realize there never has been a democracy. The people in power are not democratic. They are aristocratic. They are oligarchical. They've always been that way, and they always will be that way until they're taken out. And so now the American public are realizing that a lot of the spiel that they've been listening to from the time of Roosevelt all the way back is complete joke.
Yeah.
And that whatever comes out of these people's mouths is a total lie. Now, some people can handle that and change their political affiliations and do something different in the political milieu, or they can just continue to go along, you know, and maintain the status quo. Same thing on the relationships, same thing on the personal level. When a person starts to analyze themselves and see the way that they're operating, they can realize what kind of, you know, tyrannical aspects that they have, or realize what kind of vampiristic or violent or sadistic ways that they have. Look at their own needs. Look at their own inauthenticity. Look at their own, you know, courting. Look at how you might want to make somebody very guilty in order to have control over them. Or you might allow people in your life that make you feel very guilty. You might tolerate untold violation of your sovereignty. Why would you want to do that? So if people are abusing you and you feel under the weather, you see, and you're at work and you don't set your own boundaries and people keep violating it, well, this new energy, which is coming in the next 5 years, which has already started, is going to assist you to be able to understand what it is that helps you to bring in the very kind of adversarial, you know, action that we talked about at the beginning of the show. Now the human race is going to get an idea of what am I doing to bring that in. Yeah, I got to the point where I know that my life is full of adversity and that the world is full of adversity, but that's basically it, shtum, from that moment on. Well, that was the 20th century mentality. In the 21st century, you're going to be given the tools, you're going to get a chance to hear the teachings and the traditions that show you what you are doing to bring in the things in your life that you don't want.
You take responsibility.
Whether that's Byron Katie, you know, or Krishnamurti, I mean, there's so many teachers out there. You know, Eckhart Tolle has done some great work. You know, there's all sorts of teachers out there that are showing you what is your mind setting. What have you been conditioned to believe that brings in the kind of things that, you know, cause you to be in a inauthentic lifestyle, to cause you pain. So instead of seeing it as something external to yourself, as something that, you know, has an autonomous life, you realize that it's really articulated to something that we ourselves are doing. And this will cause a major turnaround in the world energy and in the question of empowerment, to realize how we are personally responsible for the things that happen, but to do it in a very genuine way.
Yeah, very important. The intent behind the taking responsibility of self, very important.
Yeah, and let's use these terrible, terrible things that are happening on the political level as a mirror. You know, we can stop them happening, but in the meantime, whatever's happening on the theater of the world, let it be known that you're sitting in the seats. That's just going on the stage. Because the light is on the stage, people think, oh, I can cop out. That's just happening on the stage. Oh, no, no, no. Life is a living theater in which the people in the theater cause the projection on the stage. This is what people have to realize. You're like sitting in a Greek amphitheater, but the difference with the life stage is that all the minds that are sitting there are projecting what the play that they see on the play. It's not autonomous actors just doing their thing. And once the human race understands this, then they'll realize that, hey, I don't want to play this game anymore. I'm unplugging from this because it's totally wrong. It's totally anti-natural. And then they can plug into something different, meaning plug into their inner self, plug into their own autonomous voice.
Yeah, and really live.
And really live, because 2012 will signal an ending of the world that we have known. It's not going to finish nature. Nature can never perish. But the lie will perish, and people of the lie will perish. And if those people are, you know, using the political sphere or the domestic sphere or the social sphere or whatever sphere to hide their own vampiristic nature, their own loathsome, immoral nature, well, there's another kind of action that's coming in that's going to be shining the light there and revealing those people for who they are. So this kind of revelatory action can be very, very needed for people. People who struggled a lot, people who are of the light, people who just, you know, have suffered so much, well, this can be a very good and positive and cheering time for those individuals. There's no reason to be down. What's happening now is that light is coming in to shine up the darkness. So people of the light should be very happy about that, because it's a renovative time.
Exactly. Well, I want to thank you for taking the time to come on the program this morning to share your sacred space with our sacred space.
Thank you very much, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to do so. We'll definitely do another show anytime.
Awesome. It was sure amazing. And folks, if you want to check out Michael's website, it is www.michaeltesarian.com. And I want to end here on another thing that was on Michael's website, and it is from the Hopi elders. All that we do now must be done in a sacred manner and in celebration. We are the ones we've been waiting for. And here is Mike Oldfield. Peace out.